On April 30th of 2005, Luis Rodriguez with his friends and family met at Tia Chucha's Café Cultural in Sylmar, California, to introduce his new novel, Music of the Mill.
What a beautiful day, and it's a beautiful day to introduce a new book that I think is very, very important to all of LA and to the rest of the country. It's a wonderful story, and it's a great, great way to understand what's happened to us in the last period. But again, I want to welcome you, and I'm not introducing my husband. I'm going to ask a very special friend and a really important person who knows a lot about why this book is important, and he's going to introduce Luis Rodriguez for us. So again, thank you so much for coming. I know you'll enjoy today. This is Lee Ballinger. Please welcome Lee Ballinger.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Well, Luis and I, we both came out of the steel mills. I wanted to stay. He wanted to go. There was probably 100 reasons for each of us, and every single one of them is in this book. Now, you probably don't know what those reasons are. Why not? Because the life of the industrial workers is absent from our literature. Is this deliberate? Is this a conspiracy? I don't really know, but I myself have written a novel about life in the mill. I was rejected for publication. on the basis that no one wants to read about those kind of people. Sound familiar? And we're going to prove to the publishers that they're wrong, I'm sure, today, because I know everyone here is going to buy a copy of Music of the Mill. The first thing that's really important about this book is that it tells the world what we, the people who used to be the backbone of the economy, are all about. And this book is not, I'm assuming most of you haven't read it yet, this book is not just, you know, some Discovery Channel type documentary about nuts and bolts and gears and grime. And I say that not just because there's a lot of sex and violence in here also. But, you know, in order to get a true picture from a book, what the war to make steel was like, and believe me, it was a war, we need to have people and characters that strike us with a universal note. We need to have people and characters that we can really care about, that we can really love, that we can really hate, and this book is overflowing with them. We need stories that capture our imagination, and anybody who's ever read anything that Luis has ever wrote, you know, I don't have to tell you any more about that. If this was all that Luis had accomplished with this book, it would be a great achievement, but there's much more. You know, there's an old Van Halen song that has a line, "Dream another dream. This dream is over." In Music of the Mill, Luis challenges us to see that the collapse of the steel industry, indeed the end of industrial society, is not a tragedy. It is a great blessing to humanity. Now, how can I say that? The downsizing of the steel industry almost destroyed my own family. And you can trace the growth of gangs in LA very precisely on a map that, you know, by tracing where the former industrial facilities that have been shut down are, including Bethlehem Steel, where Luis used to work. But I think this book challenges us to see that labor-intensive industry as a stage of human development was part of a worldwide web of war, of racism, of exploitation. It's good, it's very good that it's going, gone. Luis challenges us to be brave enough to imagine a completely different world. Luis wants to engage us in a dialogue about how we can live in a world where we are not subservient to blast furnaces and continuous casters, ultimately only to be discarded. Luis wants to engage us in a dialogue about the world we can have when the machinery becomes subservient to us, to our whims, to our happiness, to our unshakable drive to realize the dream of becoming fully human. So, let the dialogue begin. It gives me great pleasure to introduce one of the great writers of the 20th and the 21st century, my very good friend Luis Rodriguez.
Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me? Okay, I'm going to try to speak as loud as I can because it is hard to go over with all the machines. I want to, first of all, welcome you to our beautiful center, our beautiful cafe. Thank you for coming. And we thought that this would be the perfect place to launch this book, besides the fact that because me, my wife, and my brother-in-law own the place, but the fact that, you know, it really has to be in L.A. I just think that LA is such an important city to have this kind of book. One thing that people aren't aware of, when I go around the country, I told them I was writing a book about a steel mill, they thought it was about Chicago or Pittsburgh. And that makes sense. Those were the big steel making places. But people forget about the important industrial place that LA has had. LA is the largest manufacturing center in the country. People don't know that. They always assume Hollywood and beaches and Disneyland, and they forget that all this industry has been in LA, continues to be in LA, even though it actually, we lost so much of it in the 80s. But it's important to point that out. And I thought, I lived in Chicago 15 years. I could have done a book about steel mills in Chicago. It would have been legitimate. People would have accepted it. A lot of Mexicanos came to Chicago to work in those mills. So it would have been a good book. But I really felt the people would need to hear the LA story. Also, it's a story that I'm familiar with. I worked in that mill. I know how it is. And it's always something to me is of, you can't really know about a thing until you're really there. And even though I could probably talk about steel mills in general, I think talking about what I saw and what the people I knew in this particular steel mill was probably more important. The particular precise people and things that you learn from being in what particular place. Now, obviously, I'm going to read a few passages, but I just want to say a few things about the book. This is a fiction book. I even changed the name of the mill. And the only reason I did it is because I made the mill a character in the book. And it's a very good and bad character. And so it's kind of like, you know, if Bethlehem wanted to sue me, they could on the basis that I disparaged their character. But the reason why they couldn't sue me, though, is because you can't sue people when they tell the truth. And so that's the only thing that will keep it from, you know, getting off hand. It's also a very hard thing to talk about what happened when industry left. And this is another reason why this book had to be written. It's our story. A lot of our families worked in these industries. I mean, I'm sure you know about the whole corridor from the Northeast Valley all the way to the harbor that all the major barrios fed into, all the major neighborhoods that we know fed into them. For a long time, GM had a Van Nuys plant that a lot of families worked in. There was Price Pfister. There was all the aerospace. There was a lot of industry just in the valley that we're in. And then if you keep going down to Northeast LA and you get all the industry there, then you get all the East LA plant, then you got the Union Railroad Station, and then you got the meat packing going through Soto and some of the other communities in Vernon. You got huge meat packing there. And then you got all the mills that used to be there, the rolling mills, the steel mill. There was auto plants. There was tire plants. There was canneries. The biggest canneries were here in LA. They're all gone. I don't know if you're aware how they're all disappeared. We had the largest industries and they're completely gone. This affected our communities and people don't always talk about that. For example, I'm convinced that the 92 LA rebellion had a root in the deindustrialization. Obviously, it was a situation between police and community relations that has been longstanding in our country and in the city. But it also had root in the fact that in the 80s, these communities that burned had been devastated when that industry left. And whole communities were not able to sustain themselves through the new technology. The new technology did not integrate a lot of these communities. And you will also know that the greatest rise, as Ali alluded to, the greatest rise of gang violence in the history of this country occurred in the 80s. The two biggest cities with gang warfare is LA and Chicago, the two largest industrial cities. So there's a direct correlation between the deindustrialization and even the violence, the growing violence among gangs and the drug use and everything else that we're seeing. This is just to point out the historical, economic, social basis for what we're going through, because I always get the other side of the story. Something's wrong with us. We're prone to be violent. We're prone to be drug addicts. All this thing that you tend to hear about our communities, especially the poor communities. This is why the prisons were created, to take care of people like us. And yet, there's a total process that's not being addressed that drove people to situations in which they had to and then either join a gang, sell drugs just to survive in their communities, or work in places that cannot sustain whole families. And nobody wants to talk about that important end of it. I'll try to read a few passages, but the book is very complicated. I'm not going to be able to get into all the complexities of it, but it does deal with three generations of this family I call the Salcido family. Who starts out from Mexico, the main guy starts out from Mexico. He happens to be a Yaqui Indian, and we happen to have a Yaqui, my brother-in-law Yaqui Indian is here, who happens to come from the same area. And the Yaqui history, it's important, because the Yaqui Indians were one of the tribal groupies in Mexico that were not able to be fully conquered by the Spanish. And because they were very hard to control, as people might say, they went through hell and back. As an Indian group, they were killed at large numbers. They were dispersed all over Mexico and into Arizona, as for a period of time, they were made enslaved in Yucatan and some of the other places of Mexico. They went through a lot just by the fact that they have been fighters and have always fought for their being who they are. So even when the Spanish left, they continued to battle the Mexican government and even the U.S. government. They are a tribe that has links in Mexico and the United States. And apparently, somebody told me that they never made a treaty with the United States. So the Yaquis are actually at war with the United States. So Hector, go to war, bro. So the idea is that they're a very important tribe, and they have really important history. So the main character, Procopio, is coming from that part of the Sonora, and he's ended up into Arizona. And I won't get into all the particulars, but I will start by when he first gets a glimpse of the steel mill. Because this is different. When you're a poor indígena in Sonora, you're living off the land, you can imagine the contrast between that and a big, huge, monstrous steel mill, several miles in diameter and, you know, 100 feet high and 2 or 3 miles long buildings. You know what I'm talking about? This is a hell of a thing for somebody to have to witness who never witnessed it before. So he has he's being picked up by a couple of his homies from his paisas who found out about this job and they're going to check it out. So I'm going to just read you the passage when they're in this pickup truck and they're going into checking out the mill. When the truck pulls into Slauson Avenue, Procopio sees blocks and blocks of foundries, mills, and corrugated metal structures. Plumes of smoke from towers look like massive black birds on both sides of the street. He's unsure about this kind of work. It looks dangerous and intensely hot, but he understands it would mean better pay and a better life. When the truck approaches Nazareth Steel, that's the name I gave it. You can imagine why. The place appears monstrous to Procopio. The site goes on for blocks, enormous compared to the smaller shops that surrounded it. The buildings are 100 feet tall. They stretch for a quarter mile to a half mile long. The truck passes the row of red-hot ingots on the side street of the soaking on the street side of the soaking street pits near the mouth of the 32-inch forge. The heat sweeps over the men in the truck, and they groan in unison. Estamos chingados, Eugenio remarks. Man, we're fucked. So this just kind of opens up the reality that they're in. In those days, they would hire you right off the bat. You wouldn't have to fill out an application necessarily. They just wanted to get your address. They would look at you and just hire you. You didn't have to get a physical, and they would put you in the plant right there and then. You didn't have to have a hard hat. You didn't have to have special clothes. Whatever clothes you had, then you started working. And what I want to just tell you a little bit about how things have changed, because in those days, the mills were divided, and they still stayed divided until the day they closed. But things were beginning to change, but they were divided on race very vividly. And the bigger thing was that almost all the Mexicans that worked in the mill and all the black people, because the blacks and Mexicans were coming to South Central LA, they were at the laborers. The lowest paid position was the labor worker. The mill worker actually was a little bit better paid, and they had mostly white people, but some blacks and some Mexicans were coming in the mill parts. And the mill were the guys that actually ran the machines or, you know, were working around the machines, keeping things clean or whatever else. They were important. So you had the labor workers were the bottom. They were almost all black and Mexican. Then you had the mill workers that were mostly white, but there were some black and Mexicans coming in. And then you had the furnace workers, which were very highly paid, but it was such dirty, hard work that they brought in a lot of black and Mexicans, and they got highly paid. So these were highly paid blacks and Mexicans. You hear what I'm saying? But the work was so hard and dirty that people just gave it to them. You know, you can have that, you know. And they got paid very well. The hard group to get to was the craft employees. These were all the skilled jobs. They were the best paid. They were all white. They were very vividly anti-black and anti-Mexican. They did not want anybody in there that wasn't white. They were brought directly from the South, by the way. They came in from all these southern states. They were skilled workers from the southern states. And if they didn't have skills, they taught them really quickly. And they created a whole grouping of like a Klan group. Now, in the book, I actually call it a Ku Klux Klan group. And I know when I worked in the mill, there was a group of these whites that were Klan members. They were very active. In those days, people don't realize that L.A. had a lot of Klan going on. I don't know if people are aware of some of this history, especially in some of these big mills, that the Klan was very active in L.A. And so this is really the heart of the story, because what it is the Mexicans are coming in, and they're at a certain point realizing that they got the best thing going. Nobody hardly get these jobs. Most Mexicans were working at the at the worst jobs you could find. You worked in the steel mill, that was a badge of honor. That was special, you know what I mean? But at the same time, you were at the bottom of the steel mill. So then you have to address your own dignity, your own power, your lack of power. And the whole book really gets into the struggle for the Mexicans to get into the mill and to gain some participation in power and decision-making. What happens is the son of Procopio is the main character in the center part. This book is divided into three parts. Music, it's got a prelude, it's got a suite, and a finale. Because there's a reason why it says music of the mill, too. I'll get into that a little bit later. But the suite is the story of Johnny. He's the main guy, and he's the guy that leads the fight to change the mill. He's the guy that begins to change the mill from being all white craft units to mixed units. He was the guy that also helped bring the women in, because I happened to work there in the late 70s when the women were first coming in. And I don't know if you realize how hard that was to have women working in the mill who weren't just office workers. You know what I'm saying? They were actually working the mill. It was a big battle. And the sad thing about it is the mill closed down in the early 80s, so the women didn't have hardly any time in the mill. There was a few, of course, mills that stayed in existence, and some of them are still working. But in those days, for this particular mill, it didn't work. So I'm going to read you the section about Johnny, about something about the way the mill is, but some of the characters in the mill, because the mill is like a prison. You find amazing people in there. I mean, prisons are the same way. People would think they're not, but there's a lot of amazing people in prisons. And you work in a mill, these people have so much stories, so much character. And so I'm going to read you about some of them, and this is... goes like this. "Hey, you fire hazard," yells out one of the older millwrights from the top of an overhead crane on the 10-inch mill. Johnny has just emerged from below the mill bed, where electrical motors, crankshafts, bearings, and couplings are caked with grease, wet with oil, and speckled with flakes of steel slag. He looks down at himself and realizes he's soaked with oil and grease from his hard hat to his steel-toed shoes. "Don't have a smoke or you'll blast off, fire hazard," mocks another millwright. Fire hazard becomes Johnny's new mill name. Everyone in the craft crews has to have one. In a short time, Johnny gets to know many of these characters. There's Dirty Harry, an old Appalachian-bred millwright who never seems to be free of dirt and grime. Another is One Wrench Mike, who's the direct opposite. He always leaves work with the same spotless pressed clothes and dirt-free hard hat that he comes in with. Instead of a well-worn tool belt, he has one shiny stainless steel wrench sticking out of his back pocket, thus his moniker. He somehow manages to stay clean regardless of how dirty his assigned jobs may be. There is Rex the Mex, the one Mexican millwright who's already has 25 years time in the plant. Rex is an old-timer who calls everything he sees a chingadera. "Give me that chingadera," he tells his apprentice while pointing to some tool. Or, "Get those chingaderas over here," he says as he singles the overhead crane driver to transport equipment. Or, "If I see another one of these chingaderas on the floor, I'm going to punch somebody." Then there's Harry, a 350-pound millwright working days in the electric furnaces. He is known to have the best stories in the mill, sitting for hours on the graveyard shift or during the daytime repair days, telling stories to anyone who listen. And he does actually tell a couple stories, which I won't get into, but you get an idea about the kind of people they are. And again, this is a fiction book. I made these people up, but they're based on real people that I knew. You know what I mean? I knew some of these characters, and it was very hard for me to totally make up people, because the real people were more amazing than anybody I can come up with. And now, again, the book has a lot to it. I'm not going to read all these pages, but I just want to give you a sense of, you know, the kind of life that this is. Because when I worked in the steel mill, I had just got married. It was 1974. I got married in August of 1974. My first wife was just 2 months out of high school. And I wasn't that much older. I was like 20 years old. And about 2 months later, I got hired at Bethlehem Steel. And now, for 2 months, we were in dire straits. Before this steel mill job, we were totally poor. I mean, I call it newlywed poor. You know what I mean? When you're just barely newlywed and you ain't got nothing and you don't know where to go and you don't want to go back to mom and pops because, you know, they already think you're an idiot. And so it's like, man, and you're trying to make it, you can't get a job and everything. So it's really rough. But then I walked into Bethlehem Steel and they were hiring and I got hired. And it for me, it was like the most amazing thing that anybody could do was hire me at the steel mill. It was like the best thing that could happen. You know what I mean? And now in those days, they had to give you a hard hat. You had to get your uniform. You had to get a medical exam. Now, it was all different than it was when the mills first started bringing in people. So it was a big process. But I remember when I got my hard hat and I got my green uniform with my name. And I remember that I went to Sears and got me all these tools. You know, you always had to get Sears tools. Why do you get Sears tools, Hector? Craftsman. Because you know what? They had the best guarantee, right? If you break them, you can bring them back and they give you another one free. It's like it was the best thing going. So you always went to Sears. And you know, and I remember looking in the mirror. I was like, this is the greatest thing, man. I was like so happy to work in this mill. And of course, you know, it does help because it's a lot of money. For a lot of people, it was the first time they bought their homes. But the other side of the story is that it sounds like the greatest thing, you work in the greatest place, it's also hard, devastating work. It really takes a lot out of you. And I don't mean it just takes a lot out of your body, it takes a lot out of your soul sometimes. When I started working there, I didn't realize that it would take away a lot from me even having a family. A lot of the guys right away, they'll tell you, and a lot of this stuff is in here. Don't be married, but if you are married, just think about it as temporary. These guys have been divorced 3, 4, 5 times. Nobody could hold, that's the way they were. Nobody could hold a decent relationship because the mill took everything from you. We used to work 16-hour shifts, which meant, you know, 1 8-hour, then the next hour. We did it because there was so much good money. But you have all this money, and then you're too tired to spend it. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like, you know, you got all this money, but you're like, I don't care what happens to the money. Because it's just constant work. And I remember those shifts where it got to the point where you were like a zombie almost at a certain point. You were working so much, you couldn't even think straight. And then they had those different work rotating shifts. And I know some of you probably still work in those places, but if you ever had to work rotating shifts, you know how it totally messes you up. Because the way it used to work, we would have 1 week days, 1 week the swing shift, which was the afternoons, and then the graveyard. And then you start over again. So you couldn't even get your stabilization going because once you got stabilized, you start over again, then you'd be back, and then you kept, and it kept going back and forth. And there was always like 1 or 2 days where you only had one shift before you were back in the plant. You didn't even have a real break. You had to like get out, and then very next shift, you had to punch in again. So sometimes people would just work the 16 shifts and not even bother going home. So you see what I'm saying? This took its toll on families. And I wanted to mention this because it's very important to know. If people say, well, we want to take care of families, and people don't realize all the pressures in industry and in our society against family. You hear what I'm trying to get at? And the fact that people hang on to families is to their credit. Because people still hang on to families in spite of the fact there's all this pressure to really undermine them. It used to be when you were working, when you were an indigenous person in Mexico or even in this country, you had a certain relationship to your family and to your elders. You know what I mean? Your elders were really your teachers. And you learned from them. And you got your guidance and this internal compass that everybody's supposed to have. You got it because there was elder people that could guide you and support you and take care of you. What happened when you work in industry, that doesn't matter anymore. Your grandparents, your elders, who controls your life is that time clock, is that boss. Who don't even care about you. He don't even live in your neighborhood. You know, he don't even care what happens in your family. He's controlling what you do. And then pretty soon, it's not about a spiritual connection to family or anything else. It becomes the mill controls your life. And one of the bad things about it is the fact that in the mill there was so much alcoholism and drug use. Whites, you know, sell them in the parking lot. All the gangs made a big franchise of going to all the mills for the guys that had to stay up for all those 16-hour shifts, graveyard and everything else. They took a lot of drugs. Drinking was such a big deal. Everybody was drinking. I used to remember, the sad thing about it is these guys that were running these overhead cranes, sometimes they were drunk, you know, and they were carrying big, huge, heavy stuff, you know, and you just had to get out of their way because you don't know what was going to happen. You know, they weren't even all there sometimes. And then here's a, I'll read you this one section about payday because you get an idea about what it is to be working in the mill and not have to worry about payday. Because payday is very special in the mill. You know what I mean? That's when you get your check. Every 2 weeks on a Friday, the millwrights and other craft workers line up at the pay shanty to pick up their checks. The structure is an old, unpainted wooden shed. The Nazareth clerks open up the locks and go inside, setting up their boxes and paperwork on splintered, partly rotted shelves laden with spider webs. Workers show up in their dirty work gear and hard hats. In their hands are metal keychain tags with their employee numbers stamped on them, proof of who they are before they can receive their checks. The clerks hand out some rather juicy checks, a result of the tons of overtime and double shifts that most of the employees have accumulated. There was so much work then that steel beams and rods practically flew out of the rolling mills and forges while machines had to be repaired and sometimes taken apart and replaced. Of course, on payday, without fail, the racing forms piled up near the feet of the waiting men. The Hollywood and Santa Anita racetracks were a big draw for the construction, assembly, and mill workers throughout the Southland. In addition to the ration forms, there are flyers from nearby bars and card clubs offering meal specials on drinks and card games. And the red brick flea bag hotels on Slauson Avenue open up for hourly rates while prostitutes stand on the sidewalk or in doorways soliciting the men on their way home. Some wives wait in cars while their husbands collect their checks. Women with crossed arms, unkempt hair, and piercing stares making sure their men didn't make any detours. But for the rest, there's nothing to stop them from enjoying the fruits of their labor. More than likely, this means spending most of their checks before they even got near a bank or a check cashing outlet. So you can imagine, even if you made all this money, it was so much temptation to not even go home with it. And payday was everybody came after you. The racing forms, the prostitutes, you know, all the bars opened up. All the bars had like special drinks for mill guys. And this kind of like unfortunately made a lot of alcoholics out of people. The mill where I worked in, they had a special program of alcohol recovery just for the mill workers inside the mill. The mill had its own little hospital because people get hurt a lot. And they didn't want to go to regular hospitals. Why do you think they didn't want to go to regular hospitals? Well, publicity is one, but the other thing, time, because they wanted to fix you up and get you back working. But then the third thing is because a doctor outside would probably say, you're not fit to work. They didn't want any doctor to say that. So you might be in pretty bad shape, but they wanted their paid doctors who work for them to say, wait a minute, you're fit to work, and they send you back out there. So this is why they had their own clinic and their own hospitals. And so you had a whole city in a steel mill. At one time, Bethlehem Steel, I don't know the exact numbers because it wasn't that way. When I was there, I had about like 22,000 workers. I think when I worked there, it was like 12,000. By the time it was ending, there's only 2,000 left. But when you had big, huge 20,000 numbers of workers, you had a major, major facility that was like a city. And the thing about it, when you walked in that mill, you knew you were in a different world. You were entering the normal world and you were entering another world. The time you put your time and you walked in there and all the noise would come. The first thing you hear is that noise that after a while became like music, because all that forges pounding and all those overhead cranes moving and all the blasting of the furnaces and all these things, that's like all musical. And then there was all this stuff happening where there was you will walk through these railroad tracks and you step on a whole bunch of junk. These have all the scrap yard because all the scrap metal was what they used to put in the furnaces that they would blast and make steel out of. And there was all scrap all over the place. And, you know, it just constant noise, you know, forklifts going back and forth, people, you know, all over the place. It was another world. And you knew you were entering another world once you punched that time clock and you were in there. And then once you got out, you were back into the so-called normal world. And the funny thing about it, for all the racism that existed in these mills, everybody worked so hard that they all looked, when they walked in, they were white, black, and brown, right? But when they came out, nobody knew what color they were. Because they were so grimy that nobody, like, you were united, you know, in the mill. Somehow, for all the racism that was there, everybody had to come together because they all had to work there. So I bring all this out in this book, but I want to get into the next section of the book because there's so much in that part that I won't even get into, other than the fact that it's an ongoing battle for these workers, particularly the Mexican and black workers, to get recognition, to get their dignity. There was a consent decree signed between the United Steelworkers and all the major, the big five steel companies that changed it where they allowed people of color to show up in the craft units for the first time. And I was one of the people to benefit from it. And then eventually they let the women come in. But this was an ongoing battle. And that is the middle section, the struggle that they lose, then they eventually keep fighting, and people get killed, and there's a lot of stuff that happens before they finally win their victory. But unfortunately, it ends, that particular section ends when they finally have a victory. There's like 2 years left, and guess what? After they won, after everything looks like it's changing, the plant is closed. All that struggle, and then all of a sudden, hey, we're closing the plant. And you got guys that had 40 years working in this mill. 40 years of their life. 16-hour shifts. Unable to hold families. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know if you know the impact it was when they finally got the word this mill is going to close. It's something you cannot actually believe. How can you close this whole city? How can you close these big electric furnaces that were constantly moving day and night? How can you close these forges? And how can you do that? How can you destroy this stuff? And even if you closed it, it would still be here. It could never really die. Nobody could believe that the mill could die. And that was really, I think, the most devastating thing, because the mills were dying all over the country. And people's whole lives that had spent several generations working in the mills were now completely devastated. And these were hard, proud guys. Guys who had fought in World War II, in Korea, in Vietnam. Guys who had, you know, worked their hearts out, who loved this country. They were patriotic. They were all patriotic. You know what I'm saying? Even the communists were patriotic in there. You know what I'm saying? It was like everybody just loved the country. They would fight for the country. They would do anything for the country. But now the mill was gone, and they had nowhere to turn. And I don't know if you realize that when you have these proud people, what they do when there's no more life for them. The sad thing about it is Bethlehem Steel, this is true, is when it died, there was like a 25% rise in alcoholism. There was already a lot of alcoholism. It got worse. I think there was 8 people committed suicide the first year. One of the stories was my friend, his name is Junior, and he worked in the mill for 30-some years, and he couldn't find a job because nobody could. All you got is a skill in the steel mill. Where are you going to get a job? And their jobs, all the plants were going down. You really couldn't get a job. And one day he came home, and his girlfriend, who lived with her for many, many years, she had shot herself with a gun and blew her brains out. There was so much hurting. And the union created a food bank that became the largest food bank in the whole country. 6,000 to 10,000 families were fed in this food bank. Most of them were Mexican, black, and then the whites, who used to be racist and used to be, they were all lined up for food. And you should see how hard it was, because a lot of the women were lining up for food. It was hard for these men to be in line because of the fact that they felt so much pride. They could not be there. But then every once in a while, you look around, and there's a guy that I knew was dying just to have to be sitting there and get the food. It tears you up inside. And we created something that I want to tell you that is not in the book, but something you should know. because this was important development. This has never been done in any other country, any other part of the country that I know of, but I may be wrong. In this particular Union Hall, we created poetry and theater workshops. And my good friend of mine, Susan Franklin Tanner, who was an actress, she came in there and started doing this thing called Theater Workers Project, which became kind of famous at the time. She would get all these ex-steel workers, because they were all sitting around the Union Hall and had nothing to do, they were bored stiff, and she said, you know, we'll do some poetry and some theater. And I was very young. I came in there and I took part in the poetry workshops, and it was an amazing thing when these steel workers, who never would say anything, now started to express their story. It got so big that we got national attention, and a whole theater workers group came out of it that traveled around the country to all the Rust Belt cities, doing this beautiful theater with the words of these workers. One guy who worked like 40-some years in the plant was named Cruz. Old Mexican, worked in labor plants, and looked in the labor and then moved on up and everything else. I don't think he ever got to the craft unit, but he was very well loved. And he told his wonderful story about how he got into the mill and how this whole life had changed for him. And his story was up on stage. And it was very beautiful. I will tell you that one beautiful thing that happened is Bruce Springsteen, in 1984, was going on the Born in the USA tour. And he was going to different places like this, because a lot of the Born in the USA tour was to go to these devastated communities. And he was giving money to really interesting programs that he saw. Well, he heard about our union work. He came to the union. He bought an entourage, a lot of media. He came and sat in on one of our workshops. I remember I brought a poem that I had written about the steel mill, and I read it to him, and it was in the LA Times. People paid a lot of attention. You remember that, Victor? I don't know if you remember the story. But anyway, yeah, it was like a really amazing thing. And then he gave us some money to help with the theater workers as well as with the food bank. And I never really used to like Bruce Springsteen music. I just didn't care for it. But I really started listening to Bruce Springsteen after that, because I felt that here was finally a major pop star who had a connection with people who nobody would pay attention to, who through his songs was telling our stories. Hey, I'm glad you're here. Clarify that. But you know, the idea was that, you know, he actually went to places that nobody else would go to, and he wrote about this struggle. And so I began to have a lot of respect for Bruce Springsteen and what he was doing. But I tell you, one of the moving thing that happened, the most moving thing that happened, he invited all the steelworker guys that were in this little group to come to the sports arena and listen to his concerts. And for free, we got in free. But at one point, in the middle of this concert, you know, and I'd never been to a Bruce Springsteen concert. Have you guys ever been to him? That's an amazing thing. A guy plays for 4 hours. One song, people are totally nuts in there. You hear, they say Bruce, Bruce, all over the place. And it sounds like booze. And I go, they're booing this guy. And they're not booing him, they're saying Bruce. But I sound like they're booing him. And it keeps going and going. I go, they don't like him? This is not, but anyway, so, but what happened is at one point, he stops the whole thing and he's talking, because he does that every once in a while. And then he says, I have some steelworker friends of mine. He talks about the whole Bethlehem Steel thing, about the Theater Workers Project, and he says, they're upstairs, because we had us on top of the stairs with buckets. And he says, I'm going to have them come down, and I want you to put money in these buckets, whatever you can give. That's going to help them with their project. And that's what we did. We went down, and we raised a lot of money, and we even had a table outside. People walked out. I remember John Ritter, the actor that just died recently. He was very supportive. And again, I didn't know hardly any famous people. Steelworkers, we didn't know famous people. But we knew the good ones. We knew the good ones, because they would come and they were there. John Ritter was another supporter that came around. And I remember what Cruz said. In the first time, he says, for the first time in my life, I worked in a steel mill all my life, several generations. I think his father had worked in the mill before, and who knows how far it went back. He says, I never felt as proud as being a steelworker to that moment, because nobody had ever recognized that work that they had done. See what I'm saying? They kept the country alive. Steel makes a nation. and nobody would ever recognize him. And the many people that died because they would fall down into the electric furnaces or they would just get crushed. There's one, I'll read you one story so you have an idea about how some of that works. Because again, these are people that they're unsung. Who's going to tell their story? And I'm going to tell you about the death of one of the guys. Because these are the kind of things that happen quite often. And it was like war. Because you got to care for these people. You got to love them. And then after a while, they weren't there anymore. Let me get this part. You know, I have it all marked up. Still can't find it. You know, it's always goofy to do it that way. But anyway, here's the part. And Johnny was working in electric furnaces, and they get word that something's going on in the 10-inch mill. And he's working with this guy named Robert, this African-American guy named Robert. And Johnny and Robert, in the beginning, can't stand each other. But eventually, they become really good friends because they have to be. But at first, they just cannot stand each other. They're clashing, they're fighting and everything. But this is the kind of incidents that bring them closer together. A major commotion breaks out over the next building. An air whistle blasts several times, signaling danger. Robert stops pulling in the grease pump's hoses and looks over to where Hill's yelling. He sees people scrambling. Something's happened over the 10-inch mill, Robert explains. Come on, let's see what's going on. Robert and Johnny tear off toward the rolling mill that makes steel bars and rebar for construction. Tools clanging at their side, the men race down metal stairs and across a roadway that runs through the furnaces and the mill. Men in yellow hats crowd around someone on the floor while red-hot coils of steel rod sizzle in the air around them. Normally, the coils run in and out of a die system that shapes the bars into their proper size and strength. But as Johnny has learned during his first days working there, the rods will often run off their tracks. Labor crews will use long poles to push them back in, or if the steel begins to bunch up, shut the mill down and use acetylene torches to cut up the coils into small pieces, which are later placed in the scrap heaps and reused for furnaces. But this time, one of the fiery red rods has run off its track, piercing the stomach of a yellow-hatted crew member who had been unable to get out of the way. The rod runs out several feet on the other side of him before the mill can be shut down. A couple of men hurriedly use their gas torches to remove the pieces of steel from in front and behind the man. They lay him down as gently as they can until Nazareth's emergency medical team can arrive. Johnny looks over the huddle of men surrounding the Mexican, a man in his mid-30s, who's grimacing in pain and gasping for breath. He can't believe what he sees. The rod has gone through his body and out his back. No blood flows as the rod practically cauterizes the wound's openings, although burned intestines and other tissues have come out from behind him. The man shivers and mumbles a few words as fellow hard hats hold his head and hand. One man tells him in Spanish, "That's going to be okay. It isn't so bad." The injured man seems to calm down a little, his mouth agape like that of a hooked fish, his eyes open wide, yet not really appearing to see anything. Time stops. The roar from other parts of the plant can be heard, but Johnny feels as if a bubble has enveloped the injured man and everything around him. He hears someone praying. Johnny has seen a lot of things in his life. Friends shot, drug overdoses, shankings in prison. But something about this is more frightening, perhaps because it feels so random. Actions like these are quite common, it turns out. But the mill keeps churning out steel, keeps blasting and pounding to meet its production quotas. The one issue for everyone is not to let any section of the plant be shut down for any significant amount of time. Profit, and therefore payday, means the mill has to keep going day and night, no matter what. White and yellow striped hatted foremen from the 10-inch mill arrive and pull everyone away from the dying man. A medical wagon pulls up next to the area and parks. Two uniformed paramedics rush in and make their way to the widening arc of men. Nobody says anything as the paramedics study the situation. There's a certainty in their gaze that this man isn't going to make it. Still, they bend down to the ground, trying to make things as comfortable as possible for him. Just before the man goes into convulsions, he yells out a name, his wife, his girlfriend, somebody, Elena. The paramedic squat down next to him, holding his head and hands as the others had done before, while the man expels his last breath and then eases onto the ground. Elena is the last thing he says. So those are, thank you. Then I wanted to say briefly about the last part of the book, because again, there's so much here. I'm not going to reveal a lot of things. I know. Otherwise, you know, nobody wants to buy the book. But we'll see the movie. No, just kidding. But the last part is, you got to go from. Thanks for being here, man. Beverly, thank you, man. Thank you for being here. Thanks. Good friends of mine. The last part is completely different from these two sections, the prelude and the suite. The last part is the last generation. The mills are gone. This is the generation that's floating in the world, that doesn't know stability. This is the generation in South Central and East LA where a lot of these kids ended up. The gangs have been there for a long time, but the gangs really became bigger during that period. You had a lot more immigrants coming in because Mexico was also suffering all this job losses and everything else. And then there was more people filling in these neighborhoods, and the big jobs were gone. People were working little bucket shops. They were working service industry. They were working a lot of smaller plants. The big mills weren't there anymore. So you had a generation that I said was lost. And this is the story of one of them. The daughter of Johnny is the main protagonist for this section. And again, it's a whole different section because it's actually in a first person voice. I could not keep the third person going when I went to her. She became more immediate. And also, interesting enough, she tended to take the book to its own place. I didn't even know where she was going. I didn't know what she was doing. She became a hell of a character. She almost kicked my butt a couple of times. She would slap me around a couple of times. Don't go, no, you're going wrong, go this way. And I ended up going where she was going. A very tough girl, but the problem with her is that she was, again, very lost. Her story is that she gets into a lot of drugs, gets into a lot of alcoholism. She has a baby, but her boyfriend that she had the baby with gets killed and shot. So this is a hard life. Her brother ends up doing a life sentence, and he's a cork in prison. You guys know the story. You know what I'm saying? We know what this is like. And again, people don't always make those connections to what happened when these industries left, but they're there. We always look at it as our families are falling apart. We're no good. We're a bunch of alcoholics and addicts. And we always blame ourselves. We don't look at what the bigger picture or what were the motive forces that were put into place that forced families to fall apart, to force people to have to hurt each other, end up killing each other. A lot of child abuse, a lot of terrible things was going on. And again, you would get good people, good families, and you could see them become totally kind of mutated, distorted, not even human sometimes. But the real story is that in spite of that, humanity comes through. And in spite of that, that human strive and spirit comes through. But where the heat used to come in the steel mill, the heat that tempered your life, there was no more heat that you could look towards, and you didn't know where to find it. And this kind of kept a lot of people floating. They became more like water, unable to be contained all over the place. And so this particular girl is called Azucena, and she takes the next rest of the story. And it seems like it had nothing to do with the first part, but you'll get the idea that this book starts with displacement of the Yaquis and the Mexicanos, and it ends with displacement. But what it also begins to open up is the possibilities of a new world. Because now the industry is no longer the main stable economic base for a lot of these communities. People can look to themselves and each other for their abundance, for their families, for the who they are. The spiritual basis of who they are becomes able to be connected now, whereas before it was so tied to the church was on Sunday and then you worked the rest of the week. You know what I'm saying? It was so tied to industry and where it was happening. But now you can have a spiritual life every day, and you can think about what your purpose is in this world. And you can think about purpose, which nobody thought about. If you worked in the steel mill, your purpose was to make steel. That's it. But now you can think about, maybe I had another purpose in this world. This particular young girl, this is where the music also comes in, wants to be a singer. And she had this dream to be a singer. And I used to know people who wanted to be singers that worked in the steel mill, though never became singers. But they wanted, and they could sing, but they would never be able to do it. And so finally, she is in a place where she finally can see what her true destiny is. And the spirit comes from knowing that there's another world that's possible, and that a lot of the destruction that was totally inherent in the way the system has set up could possibly be changed when you looked at what the possibilities in the abundance and in the advanced technology, what was possible, that's still possible today. Because we have technology that can do amazing things. And the fact that most of us aren't tied into it doesn't mean that it's not possible to still do amazing things. I mean, there's things that I don't even know, because I have a good friend of mine. I don't know if Frank Curtis is here, but if he's not, he's a former steel worker. He used to work with us, but he reads all this stuff. And he calls me up and tells me, you got to read this book, Fantastic Voyage, about new things. And it's all real stuff. Science is being creating new possibilities, but it's still being held in the hands of a few people. It's still not being able to come to be the possession of the people who worked the mills, who worked the plants, who worked the factories, who still work today. Somehow it's still in the possession of people who have power and money. And we have to think about how that could change, because that technology, once liberated, can liberate all of us. Right now, it just holds everybody back. See what I'm saying? And we're constantly trying to figure out where we're going and why we're not going anywhere. And so I think there's a seed that I'm trying to plant, that the displacement that happened, those many years, to even the displacement in the 80s, to all the ongoing displacement we're seeing today, the possibility that maybe through song, through poetry, to a wonderful story, things would change. Things would become what they should be. And that our humanity, despite all the dehumanization that continues today, our humanity will still be born and still thrive. So I'm going to end with and I don't mind telling you this part because it's in the book. Johnny is dying. In the third part, he's dying the whole time that Azucena is telling her story. I know. He's dying because of all the cancers and everything that happened, because you worked in these mills. You know, cancer comes from a lot of different things, but a lot of it has to do with the environment. And the environment that's very polluted and toxic. And we're all in that environment. Somehow we all feeding off it. And a lot of these mills and plants that contribute to the mutation of our cells, that also mutated our social lives, our family lives, but also the lives within our bodies. So he's dying. And so this part is the very end where Azucena and our Procopio comes in. Now he's called Lito for being abuelito. He's Lito in the book. And I'll read you this one section so you know. Even though it's the end of the book, there's a lot more I'm not telling you. So don't think that I'm giving you any secrets. I'm not giving away nothing. Okay? This is Azucena talking. Rain begins to fall. My parents once told me I was born in the rain. As my dad lies still, we pull up chairs and gather around. I stay up, listening to the rain's melody on the roof and gutters. I can't sleep anyway. My son Jandro curls up and then snoozes in one of the chairs. A tall 12-year-old, he looks like a small child just then. I reach over and gently mush his hair. My boyfriend Pancho strolls in and out of the room, half asleep, unsure of what to say or do. It's probably better that he doesn't say anything. Regardless, I'm glad he's here. My uncles stick around for a while, talking among themselves and to Lito, who's in the kitchen, mostly just listening to everything around him. Johnny's breathing has been shallow all night. Sometimes it's hard to tell if he's breathing at all. After a while, the rain stops. In moments, I hear a single bird chirp. Then the sun bursts through the clouds. Just as the dawn breaks, Johnny breathes in deeply. Araceli, her mom, reaches out to me and with one hand while she places her other hand on Johnny's chest. In that inhalation, my father takes in the room, the smells, our presence, our sorrow, and our love. I'm hoping it carries him wherever he's going. Then he lets out a long, drawn-out breath. Emotions begin to rise within me, uneasily at first, then in torrents. Araceli cries softly. I envision Johnny and her in each other's arms long ago, back when they were young, full of fire and verve. I glance over at Jandro. I don't want him to wake. I'll tell him later about his grandfather's last breath. Pancho walks in. He appears but is now fully awake. He walks up behind me and gently places both hands on my shoulders. In a watery moment, time wanes. It reflects, sitting in the room with us, and it just stares. In that pocket of held breath, I think about death with more concentration than I've ever done so before, despite all the death I've known in my life. People die, but then they don't die. They leave ideas, impressions, remembrances, art, words, and this is how they live forever. My father used to think the steel mill would never die. He couldn't imagine that steel was an inexhaustible commodity, or that the march of technology and market and the markets could destroy his precious mill once and for all. Johnny may have had his battles in the mill. He may have disagreed with how things were done, how people managed the plant, or the way they broke workers down, misusing them, dividing them, scaring them, and then lying to them. But he learned to love the work. He learned to love the machines and the way steel's properties were melted, poured, shaped, and hardened. And perhaps he saw a similarity to human beings there. Johnny grew up. He matured in the mill. He found his heart and his life there. Yes, Nazareth Steel had to die. But the deathless push-pull of humanity and nature, of mind and matter, of fiery creativity against finite reality will continue to clash, curl, connect, and grow. This would always be there. In the end, I think this is what Johnny loved. So I want to thank you for being here. In many ways, even though I worked in those plants, I think Diachuches is the realization of a lot of this. Diachuches is that kind of a place that gets born when you don't have to look to others to find your purpose and meaning, where you really look inside yourself and say it's there. And we help each other to realize those meaning and those purposes. And we create a community that allows those purposes to bear fruit, to go somewhere, to actually accomplish something. And so I have in the book a place like this, where Azucena finds it. And in that kind of place, she begins to find her bearing and her connection. And then she gets into a sweat lodge, because she begins to find that even when her indigenous life is not all gone, and she'll get back to it. And these are the kind of things that has happened here and in other places. So I do think that out of everything that's being said about what happened in those times, all the pain from the wars that we're still continuing today, all the pain from the kind of industry that sometimes we're stuck to and we can't seem to leave, where kids don't know what futures they have, where they don't even care if they go to school and finish school because their futures aren't even good enough to think about, where kids, some of them, are even killing themselves because they know there's nothing else to live for, that we can find that hope and those dreams and find that community so that we can keep ourselves looking at the right place, looking at each other, caring for each other, and keeping that humanity and that human heart going. So I want to thank you, because that's really what the story. I want to thank you for being here. What we're going to do is we're going to have some beautiful music, and I want you to hang, just party. We don't have any other events going on later this evening, so I'm going to be here, and I will sign books. I actually will sign them over here. Okay, I will sign books over there. So if you got books, we'll have the staff work out a line and everything. But again, I am so honored that you're here. It's really hard to write these books. It's really hard to get published. It's hard for anybody to pay attention. Some of you might have been aware that the LA Times last Sunday gave a terrible review to Music of the Mill. It gave a terrible review. But I will tell you, I have 5 good reviews, and this is a bad one. What's really sad, is that the LA Times should have got this book. You know what I mean? The LA Times should have really talked about it. And I don't even care if the guy, I know who he is. I don't even care if he didn't like the book. I don't even care if he thinks there's flaws in it. That's okay. You can critique it, but don't dismiss it. Do a thoughtful review. Talk about what's good in it and talk about what's bad in it, but don't dismiss this book. And that's what it was. And I think that that's a big, terrible shame for the LA Times that this happened. So anyway, but we're going to move forward. We're going to move onward. We're not going to let that kind of stop us. We're going to keep going, because that's what we have to do. So thank you. Muchas gracias. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
felicidad serían para ti. Vida, si te llevas mi vida contento, moriría por ti. Alma, si te llevas mi alma contento, moriría por ti. Ser, si mi ser te llevas contigo, moriría por ti. Corazón, si mi corazón te llevas mi alma, mi vida y mi ser, tuviera cuatro vidas serían para ti.
You have been listening to Luis Rodriguez introducing his new novel, Music of the Mill, at Tia Chucha's Café Cultural in Sylmar, California, on April 30th, 2005. The music was provided by Amor y Paz. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.